How's transportation? Is it back to normal? What a day.
How's
that? Better. The report was good. We see the orthopedic surgeon in 6 weeks now. So that's a good sign. It's healing. Okay, I can begin. We're set, Yomo? Rolling? Belongs like that? Okay. Today is October 9th, 2016. We're here in the shadow of Yom Kippur. Ani modela Kadosh Baruch Hu, my wife, some of you know, I received a lot of emails. The shurim I didn't give. My wife fell on Shabbat. Sunday morning, we started the process of terem to the emergency room. Monday, Kupa Muchedet, the orthopedic surgeon. Tuesday, Yad Sara. But the patient was x-rayed today, and the doctor saw her, and thank God the report is good, that it's healing properly, and I thank you all for your good wishes. And the Ribbono Shel Olam, as my wife says, Techal Shana Uklalateha, Utechal Shana Ubirchoteha. A Gemach HaTimatova to all my students, both those in front and those listening across the vast expanse of the Jewish world. I have today, the first part of today's lecture is extremely important. And I'm not going to come back to it again because you'll understand I've reached conclusions. But I just want to mention that Josh Schneider, my student in West Hempstead, sent me the following comment. I mentioned Leon Chani, who was my classmate, and he just died. Unfortunately, at my age, every day I get bad news, and it's not just my contemporaries, but my students, and Rabbi Shmuel Bernstein just died. I remember him as a kid. I was Ben Bayit in his home. His father was my Rebbe, Reb Noach, Zekes Echronim Tzadikim Vavracha. Anyway, Josh writes about Leon Chani. He was a billionaire and reported to be the wealthiest Yeshiva College alumni. I should recall his good deeds as my father does whenever his name comes up. He was very good to Yossi Winevsky. You know who Yossi Winevsky was, Zichrono Livracha? He was a blind student in the yeshiva who got smicha. I even think they arranged for him to do a little teaching. He was a very fine individual, Yorei V'sholem. I remember him. He evidently had a drop of vision. He had a big magnifying gimmick that he could see a text. It was magnified and magnified. And he was very good to Yossi Winevsky. I think if Yossi needed money or something extra, he got it from Chani. My father even speculates that he was having problems at the yeshiva, work-related. Chani would put pressure on the administration. So I want to say that I stand in awe of my classmate. He was just one of the boys, as I remember him. He was from Bayonne, New Jersey, if I recall correctly. And amazing how some of our classmates turned out to be world-class acts. Now, we're here in the world of, we're using Rabbi Menashe Klein as a springboard to understand hundreds of questions that he dealt with in the 20th century into the 21st century. What's unique about Rabbi Menashe Klein, we've spoken about his background, his friendship with Elie Wiesel. And here was a man, the Yungar Bar Rav, who was living in two worlds. He came from Hungary, Baropark, that was his world, and yet he was attuned to everything happening around him and ultimately builds a branch of Yungar Bar in Ramot, where his son today is the Rav. And that shul was built with the Nobel Prize money that Elie Wiesel got. And he gets involved with the whole question of feminism, which has haunted us for so long. And he writes this long tshuva, many tshuva, to why you graduate, to why you frima. And it's fascinating. I showed you last time where he and the Rav really run parallel. And whenever people talk about feminism, I always give the same example the Rav gave and Rabbi Menashe Klein, Chana, how we learn prayer from Chana. And nevertheless, Chana cannot be counted for a minyan. So it shows you the Torah is not dealing here with common sense. We have to take our Western common sense out of it. It's not Korach, Talit Shekulo Tchelet. And we have to surrender to the Torah system, and we have to work within the Torah system. It doesn't mean that they can't be Chiddush. Some of you know, over the generations of teaching, I've often quoted the Gemara in Chulin Daf Zayin. I've attempted to answer questions. I don't want to repeat myself, and I apologize for being flippant, so Ami Magazine can criticize me again for being flippant. But I have what to teach. I have so much more to teach. I don't want to repeat myself. But I spoke so many times about Korach and common sense and the marketplace and mercantile sense. But it's not that Torah is against Chiddush, and the Rev makes this point. If Torah would be against Chiddush, how could there be a Reb Chaim Brisker? How could there be a Baal Tanya? How could there be a Lubavitcher Rebbe? But Chiddush has to be within the Torah system. And here I want to go into the contemporary world and once again fine-tune and show you something that I didn't have when I gave the last year. And you all know that today there's a tremendous movement going on, innovation, Chovevei Torah. So many people are talking about revising and revamping. I understand Rabbi Riskin in his Tshuva Drasha also spoke about lesbians and homos, and we have to be more open to them. Again, I've dealt with these topics in great detail. Now is not the time to repeat myself. But I have to tell you, Chiddush has to be within the Torah system. And you have to have a certain sense of humility. I've gotten a few compliments over the years on my Shayurim and my published writings. I just got a wonderful compliment on my new book, which will be launched here November 1st. I apologize, but because I dedicated the volume to charity, so we did launch it in America, and it did bring in some very wonderful money for Russian, for the spiritual absorption and spiritual outreach to Russian Jewry, Shvatami. And the first copies were sent to America. This is why the book was actually printed in the Ukraine, in Kiev. And this is why we are launching it here November 1st. I have to check that the copies are in. I believe they are. Are they in there, Yomo? Have you seen? You don't know. Have to call Alan Rosen, and we have everything ready for the book launch November 1st. So you see, in this volume, it's 370 pages, I deal with two topics, two critical topics that rabbis suffer with, classic Aguna and Mamzeret. And I show you some very interesting innovative halachic thinking, but all this innovative halachic thinking had to be within the context of Torah Sheba'al Peh. And this is what the Rav said, and this is what every posek will explain to you and tell you. And you have to have a sense of humility. What's a sense of humility mean? So someone compliments me and says, "Ah, that was a good shiur, that what you write in your book." And I look at them, who am I, what am I? I see the Rav in front of me. And I'll be honest with you, I thank you for your compliments. I wish I could get a compliment from the Rav. Do I have to elaborate? This is what Torah is about. This is what acceptance of Torah, continuity of Torah. And this is the famous story. I repeat it again. I was an eyewitness to it. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky on the plane with Yeruchim Meshel, the head of the Histadrut. I was on that same plane, 1980, sitting right next to them. They were in the bulk seat right in front. I was right on the side. I was going to Denver, Colorado, being sent by the Jewish agency. It was to be scholar in residence on the University of Denver campus. The idea was to bring people with scholarly credentials, but the real purpose was to combat Palestinian propaganda, which today has taken over part of the Jewish world as well. Lo aleinu, forget about Obama, Kerry, who's an anacle of the Maral's brother, And our poor prime minister, I pity him. It hurts me that he has to go crawling to America, open the Bible and read the Bible to Obama and challenge your Bible to curse the Bible. Fine. If he curses the Bible in public, well, all right, that's his privilege. No different than some of our candidates for presidency and what they command of in public. Anyway, coming back here, so on the plane, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Yerucha Meshel are involved in this heavy conversation, and in Yiddish, in Mamaloshen, for Rabbi Yaakov, I don't know how good his Hebrew was, but Rabbi Yerucha Meshel and Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres and David Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann and Yitzhak Ben Tzvi and that entire generation, their native language was Yiddish. And standing over Rabbi Yaakov, I see it in front of me, I relive it, was a tall fellow with a beard, with the uniform, what we call the uniform. I don't wear a uniform, but if you want to wear a uniform, Gesundheit. I'm from a different generation. Standing over Rabbi Yaakov, and finally Yerucha Meshel asks Rabbi Yaakov, who is that? And Rabbi Yaakov tells him, this is my nenekel, it's my grandson. And Yerucha Meshel says to Rabbi Yaakov, your grandson, Avi, and you have something in common with him? My grandchildren don't even talk to me. So Rabbi Yaakov says to him with a shmeichel, with a smile, he says, I'll explain to you. You who are part of the Ben-Gurion crowd, the Mapai crowd, you believe that man came from monkeys. So why should your grandchildren want to talk to you? You're two generations closer to a monkey than he is. But we Jews believe in Maimon HaSinai, and I'm two generations closer to Maimon HaSinai. That's why my grandson hovers over me, to be near a Jew who's two generations closer to Maimon HaSinai. And that's such a brilliant, powerful answer. And I always tell people, I'm a nobody, but I had the schut to learn with the Rav. And if I can pass that feeling on, then there's humility, then you have to think, then you're not going to shout and think, wow, you're bigger than your rebbeim. Now, let me go one step further. And I reached the conclusion, and I hope I'm wrong, I pray that I'm wrong, Simon, but I hope, I have a feeling I'm not wrong. In 100 years, we'll be able to look back and see. Chovevei Torah is here to stay. It's a whole movement. It doesn't mean they're from people in Chovevei Torah. Those of you that have heard my lectures on the history of conservative and reform, I gave it many years ago. Not in the history of Torah in America. It was part of the 10-year series on questions my students asked me. I know the history. Unfortunately, I have a doctorate in American Jewish history. If I know anything, halavai would know Shas and Poskim, like I know the history of Torah in the United States. So in the seminary in 1916, there were plenty of from Jews, but the move was already on. We have to innovate. We have to change. We can't go on like this. We can't stagnate. Now, Chaim Snitzer is a Talmud of mine, I believe, from Montreal. He sent me a little booklet that was published toward a meaningful bar mitzvah. I don't want to mention the girl's name. I don't know where she's at today. I think this is about the year 2000, 2002. And she has her own minion, and a 12-year-old girl decides to innovate and say Davar Shebekedusha with 10 women. I mean, it's a 12-year-old girl, and the father is proud of her, the mother is proud of her. And you see what they write, and they really believe it. I'm quoting, as Blue Greenberg has stated, history shows that where there has been a rabbinic will, there has been a galactic will. Well, if you believe that, that's absolute, total, complete conservative Judaism. Believe me, if there's a rabbinic will, halavai, we could solve the problem of the contemporary aguna. The classic aguna problem is 99% solved. Halachically, you'll read my work, you'll understand. But the contemporary aguna where a man holds up a woman for money, halavai, we can solve it. I wish we could solve it. So far, we don't have a perfect solution. If you want, one of the reasons for coming in Aliyah to Israel, Abraham, is because here we do have a solution. The Beit Din has power. We can imprison someone. We can send them into solitary confinement. We can do things that you can't do in the United States. But if you really believe that there's a rabbinic will, and what, it doesn't break your heart when, remember what I read to you last week from the Rav's talk, that this girl, non-Jewish, that's interested in Judaism, converts, becomes a Shomeret Shabbat in graduate school. She meets a typical American kid who doesn't know an aleph from a bet, and they start going out, and the kid starts becoming frum, and he wants to find out about his forebears, and he goes to the cemetery, and he sees on the tombstone the split fingers, and he thought it was some Masonic lodge. I can tell you about Masonic Lodge. One time Dr. Belkin asked me to speak at a Masonic Lodge to do him a favor, it was either the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side. And I understood there were multi-billionaires there, and it meant a lot to Yeshiva. I couldn't get over the way the meeting began with incense, with candle lighting, with hocus pocus. They tell me it's not a Avodah Zarah. I don't know. I'll let Rabbi Rubin decide.
I never heard of it. No incense and no candle.
I was there. I saw with my own eyes. And B'didi HaViyuvda. So he thought it was some sort of Kabbalistic, I don't know, esoteric concept. He went to his rabbi, brought the rabbi a picture, and said, you're a Kohen. No, you're a Kohen. You can't marry a Giyoret. No, doesn't that break your heart? The Rav said it. But what can I do? This is the halacha. But if you, but this is Mamishkins. And
they couldn't have worked it out that he becomes a Kabbal.
It's a lot of the writer, halal. B'dieved, this I can tell you, if someone was married, a Kohen, to a Gerusha, or to, and they become Balei Tshuva, so there were cases with children in Teaneck, and the Rav did not say anything that they knew they would not get divorced. He dealt with the children. He didn't say anything about the parents, but that's accepting a B'dieved. This is a lachatchila, you see, but if you believe this, and these people believe it, not only that, in this entire publication, where there are essays by Blue Greenberg and Erwin Greenberg, Yitzchak Greenberg, time and again, what do I see? Hillel Tikkun Prizpal. Gentlemen, in 2016, go back 100 years to the seminary. Any of you familiar with what's been written by the seminary people for the sake of argument, Waxman's famous book, Tradition and Change? Time and again, all you will hear is Hillel Tikkun Prizpal. Dovi, if Hillel could solve the problem of Shvius by being Metaken a Prizpal, then we can solve every problem, and we can drive to Shul, and we can have a Kohen to the earth. It's only one problem. Hillel didn't innovate anything. I gave Shurim on this. Again, I can't elaborate it. Hillel Tikkun Prizpal, it means he took one law, one halacha, and used it for everyone. There's an open halacha, Moshe Shtaratav LeBeitin, that if you give your Shtarat to Beitin, Shmita is not Meshamet. All right, so we advise people, give it to Beitin. What there is innovative, the innovativeness is telling people, use this halachic approach. The same thing the conservative movement always quotes, Mechirat Chametz. Mechirat Chametz, first of all, Al Pi Din Torah, if we're Mevatel Chametz, if we say the beetle, the Chametz is not ours anymore. Mechirat Chametz is Lahandil Torah Lahadira, to add strength that you should feel. It's not just your Mevatel, but you sold it, it's gone, it's out of your possession.
Let me tell you,
I had a Rebbe, Reb Yosef Weiss, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who took his few liquor bottles left down to the Harlem River, turned them over, and poured it out.
But not what the average Jew
No, forget about that. In Poland, people had tremendous liquor businesses. But there was a halachic solution. Bitul and then Mechira. And if you want to see an essay that has all the sources and shows you what Mechira Kametz is all about, Reb Shlomo Yosef Zevin in Moadim Bahalacha. It's one of his most beautiful pieces. He was a master. He first of all, I knew Reb Shlomo Yosef, I knew Shas and Paiskim. He was a Chabadnik of the old school. Halavai, we had 1,000 Chabadnikim like that today. The whole world would be different. And what an individual. So read his essay. But this brochure, article, monograph, call it what you wish, is filled with the same sources the conservative movement quoted. After seeing that book that I guess you want someone else to take it now? Yitzchak, all right, I have a gift for you today, but it's not on that level. It's on the level that we live as good American youngsters. If you, these are exactly what was quoted in every responsum written in the conservative movement. And if this is what we're talking about, a 12-year-old girl decides, Davisha Bekdusha. By the way, Rabbi Berman, Saul Berman, writes very strongly that you can't say Kaddish, you can't say Kedusha, but this girl made her decision. I don't know where she's at today, but interesting to know, she has to be hitting close to 30, where she's at today. But this is my humble conclusion. I contrast it, but what I showed you at the end of the class, and I thank Richard Rosenberg, and here you have to understand David Stavsky, you're a little older than me in yeshiva, but why you Reitz, whatever you want to call it, was very small then. A high school freshman and someone getting smicha were in the same yeshiva. B'sach HaKol, maybe there were 500 students in Reitz, maybe. And the day I walked into yeshiva, September 1951, that's the day I met Baron Lichtenstein. We knew him as the Babe. So could you imagine a little kid like myself already knew Reb Baron in 1951? All right, they were 5 years. He was 5 years older than I am. But we were buddies. We played basketball together. Reb Baron was a very good. He was tall. He was good. It's a world gone by, Rabaran, photographic memory, Tzadik Yisod Olam. I can tell you endless stories. When he got engaged to Tova, so you know everyone likes to dig. So we did, we said to Rabaran, are you going to use Velveeta cheese? And Rav said, no, Baruch Hashem. In Brooklyn already we had Migdal cheese at that time. In Boston they used Velveeta. The Rav was Makiel on the enzymes, on kosher gelatin. On gelatin he followed Rav Chaim Isaac Grzynski, you understand? But Rav Baron we knew was from Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn no one used Velveeta cheese. And so I remember we were digging Rav Baron. Are you going to use Velveeta cheese? He said, no. In Brooklyn, Baruch Hashem, in New York, we have Migdal. So you see, David, I remember David's guy sitting in front of me. I taught his grandson in this kollel, Tuli Weiss, who later was rabbi. I understand he came in Aliyah a number of years ago. Wonderful young man. And you see, just think for a minute what Richard Rosenberg told us about his life, that at the end of his life, he asked Richard to put together a collage, and he was on his deathbed, and he wanted to face the picture of all his Rebbeim. Here he is with Reb Moshe Feinstein, here he is with Reb Lazer Silver, here he is with Reb Shmuel Belkin, here he is with Yerim Yerelik, here he is with the Rub, here he is with Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, here he is with Reb Mordechai Gifta, here he is with Reb David Lifshitz. This is a Jew. Now, there were two pictures we didn't solve. One of them we now have solved. I was right in my guess. Here is the David Stavsky with the helmets of Rebbe. Rabbi Hananya Yomtov Lippe Deutsch, who was a great expert in Erev. And he evidently came to Harrisburg to put up Erev to be Makshiv Erev. The one picture I haven't solved, and I asked Yomo to show it to Reb Lazer Kugel, here is Reb David Skavsky. This has to be a Litvish Rosh Yeshiva. The question is, Who is it? Is this Reb Yitzchak Isaac Sher? Who is it? Could be. Is it? Did you show it to Rav Kogel? What are you, Yomo, what are you waiting for? The world is waiting for you to show it to Rav Kogel and be able to report back to us. And now, let me go one step further. The last material on this topic. Am I right or wrong? Compromise, does it help? Doesn't it help? And here I want to thank a Talmud, a virtual Talmud, Yehuda Frege, who happens to be the son-in-law of two Talmidim of mine. His father is Charlie Black, who is Block, who is one of the first Talmidim of BMT. It goes back 47 years, I would say. Charlie married Nancy Breyer. Nancy Breyer was my Rebbe professor's daughter, Menachem Breyer's daughter. Nancy, very bright. What is her yichus today? Her brother is the Biyana Rebbe. Those of you who know what I'm talking about, there's a very famous Rebbe today who was born and bred in the United States, American, as blueberry pie. And he listens to my lectures, and he came across a very fascinating volume, something I've mentioned in class. And if you can get hold of the volume, it's kedai to read to understand. And let me just tell you, the volume is, let me just give you the exact name. Let's not, if we have the exact name, it's on Rabbi Harry Epstein, who I quoted to you. Rabbi Harry Epstein later becomes the rabbi in Atlanta, and I told you about Atlanta. The man was the rabbi of the biggest synagogue, the biggest temple. He was revered. Oh, when he died, his very room that was his office remained sealed from the public. Mark K. Bauman, remained a shrine for the public, I should say. Mark K. Bauman, who I did a little drop of research on, he was a professor of history, particularly specializing in the history of the Jews in Atlanta. He also did research on the Afro-American population in Georgia, and he did a volume on Harry Epstein. The volume is called Harry H. Epstein and the Rabbinate as a Conduit for Change, okay, by Mark K. Bauman. That's the volume that I'm quoting from. Now, to briefly summarize, I mentioned to you Rabbi Epstein. Why did I mention it to you? Here was a man, Harry Epstein, whose father was Rabbi Ephraim Epstein, the leading Orthodox rabbi in Chicago. More than that, his uncle was the Lavush Mordechai, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva. We're talking Reb the Lavush Mordechai, that was a brother-in-law of Reb Yisrael Zalman Meltzer. These were sons-in-law of Frank, the Frank family in Kovna. You don't have greater Litvish Yichis, you don't have a greater Talmud Chacham, a greater Rosh Yeshiva than Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein. Reb Ephraim Epstein was his younger brother. He wound up in America, he wound up in Chicago, he was the dean of the Orthodox Rabbinate. Here he has a very capable son, Harry. Harry studies in Slabodka in Europe. Harry studies in Hebron with his uncle. They're the ones that opened the Hebron Yeshiva in Hebron, which today is the Hebron Yeshiva, a two-minute walk from Torah Shraga and from Gris Kolel. And here this man who began his first position was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he was in the shul that Rabbi Rebel's family established. Tulsa, Oklahoma, the oil industry, the Travis family that Rabbi Rebel's father-in-law, brothers-in-law, they built the shul. That's where he first began. And then he comes to Georgia, where he led congregation Ahavat Achim,
a synagogue facing a serious generational split. The older Yiddish-speaking generation wanted an old-time religion, while the younger American generation demanded a faith in accordance with the times. Rabbi Epstein had the diverse skills to address the older generation with his traditional yeshiva abilities, and the younger generation with his college degree, his postgraduate degrees. He taught advanced Talmud and preached eloquently in English. Worried about losing the younger generation, he slowly accommodated change in the synagogue, a more westernized and less religiously committed population. And the volume describes the changes. These are changes that if you study American Torah history, you're going to come upon these changes. You can't escape them. For instance, the late Friday night service. Think for a minute. Everyone worked on Friday. When Shabbos comes in early, it's not like today that in the state of New York, and there may be other states where according to law, your employee has to allow you enough time to get home before Shabbat. I mean, it's an amazing world today. In those days, no one got home before Shabbat. So you're going to have services at the regular time. All you'll have are the retired Jews from the old generation. So he introduced late Friday night services. Do you know what it was composed of? It was all over America. If Shabbos began at 4:30, so at 7:30 they came together, they said some Tehillim, they might have said Lecha Dodi, then the rabbi spoke, they had a guest lecturer, they had a book review, they had an Oneg Shabbat. It was a totally different world. It was a social mix. In the Reform synagogues, and this I saw with my own eyes twice in my life, and my eyes still burn, I can't handle it. It was interesting, I asked Balei Tshuva from Atlanta, Georgia, who saw it, and they said, no, we have to be makariv them. They didn't react the way I did. I said, I can't look at it. I saw twice in my life in a Reform service, 3 hours after Shabbat began, the service began. The one I saw in America that I write about in Washington, with the mother of the week lighting Sabbath candles 3 hours into Shabbat. In Yerushalayim, at the convention of the Jewish Assembly, whatever they call it, part of the Jewish agency, hundreds of women lighting Sabbath candles 3 hours after Shabbat began. So here, this was an attempt not to have Shabbos candles, but this was already conservative Judaism. And then the pressures built up, and by the early 1950s, he agrees to take down the mechitza. You wind up with a shul, one section for men, one section for women, and the heart of the sanctuary, mixed seating. He advocated bat mitzvahs, mixed seating, and participation in services, but he blanched at the idea of women reading from the Torah. You see, it's exactly the way the conservative movement began. Women should read from the Torah, chas v'chalila. At first, they didn't give aliyah to women, and it's a whole process that begins slowly. But once you compromise the halacha, what begins on a small level later will continue. And he, on a family level, he paid a very heavy price. His wife, who was the daughter of a prominent rabbi, she too was very, very upset. Publicly, she supported him. At home, she reprimanded him. She rebuked him. His own father stopped corresponding with his son. Reb Ephraim Epstein was so upset that
He couldn't talk to his son here, the most prominent rabbi in Atlanta, Georgia, and the mechitza is gone. But here's what's fascinating. Here is a man who went along with the crowd, built a tremendous conservative temple, and when Professor Bauman interviewed him in the 1980s, to the interviewer during, I'm quoting from page 108 now, to the interviewer during the 1980s, the rabbi bemoaned his decision to join the conservative ranks. Conservatism had become too nebulous. It lacked substance and was too willing to compromise fundamentals. Rabbi Epstein perceived very little difference between conservative and reform. And he believed that many conservative rabbis were virtually theistic in their perception of God. Reason had fought with faith and won the day. The rabbi seemed to feel that his actions only delayed and may have exacerbated an almost inevitable decline. And you see, that's a very, very sad comment, that a man who, the biggest synagogue, the biggest temple, on top of the world, revered, a man who was a Talmud Chacham, and here already, when he's on in years, retired, and he lived a good life, he died, I believe, over 100, a long life, retired, and he bemoans the fact that he went along with the conservative movement, and take a look what became of it. Harry Epstein told the story of the Rabbi of Sons. As a young man, this rabbi hoped to reform the world. When he grew older, he concluded that this task was too tall an order for one man. He would reform one country. Later, the Rabbi of Sons became contented with the goal of perfecting his community and then simply his family. Finally, the rabbi accepted the responsibility of perfecting himself as a sufficiently demanding task. Did not Rabbi Epstein associate himself with the life cycle of the Rabbi of Sons? And that part is told about many, many people. It's told about Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, that when he started out in Kovna, In 1840, he wanted to convert the whole world. And you all know what happened, in Vilna in 1840. He wanted to convert the whole world. By the time he reached Kovna in 1849, I think it was, he already was satisfied with just converting his devoted followers. When he wound up in Germany and Paris, he understood his biggest struggle was to keep Rabbi Yisrael Lipkin, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, walking on the path of righteousness. All right, it's a very fascinating article about Rabbi Harry Epstein. Let me end off just at the end of the article, and this is very important.
Who's the author?
Bauman. That's who I quoted. He wrote the book. It's not an article. It's a book. Mark Bauman, B-A-U-M-A-N, Mark Bauman, let me just see if I have it right here, one N, and it's a very, very fascinating article. It's a mamish, a case study before your eyes of what happens when you start compromising. Putting it to parentheses, there's another point here that's very, very important, and this, I hope, today has been ameliorated. In the Orthodox shuls, the old-time shuls, time and again, when a rabbi died, it was very sad for the family because there were no provisions made to take care of the widow. And yeah, there's some horror stories in the American rabbinate
And balabatma balabatam, you understand, their concern is money, continuity, the rabbi is too old, the rabbi doesn't speak to the new generation. You've all heard many of these stories. I've often said that when Yitz and I were growing up, there was nothing greater we could do than to become rabbanim. Today, all the bright fellas want to be Rosh Yeshiva. And there's a big difference between being a rabbi and a Rosh Yeshiva. A rabbi, the older he gets, he's weaker, he can't do all that he has to do. Perhaps he doesn't know the baseball scores, so the balabatim are complaining. But a Rosh Yeshiva, the older he gets, the more valuable he is. Here's a man who actually was an intimate Talmud of Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. Here's a person who spoke to Rav Moshe Feinstein in learning. Here's a person who spoke with the Baron Cutler. You understand? You become more valuable. And we have some very big horror stories. The conservative rabbinate fought many battles that Rabbanim, when they got their contracts provided for death, for family. So he makes the point here that his father saw, Harry Epstein saw what his father went through. When his father died, his mother was left penniless. The balabatim kicked her out of the house that she was in. It was a parsonage. The new rabbi has to come in. Conscious that his father's congregation cut off support from his mother a few years after his father's death, Epstein made certain that provisions for himself and his wife were specified in contractual form, delineating the manner in which they would continue to participate in the life of the congregation in a very respected fashion. And that's a lesson which I hope today in the Orthodox rabbinate is ameliorated, and a rabbi can live in dignity and die in dignity, and his family will be taken care of. It's an interesting point. At the end, he describes how, with the retirement, becoming rabbi emeritus, all the honor that came his way, and honorary degrees, and everyone looked up to him, and the senior rabbi, and yet his heart was broken. Chilul Shabbos, Kashrut, abolished, generation long since gone. No one speaking Yiddish, obviously. The old time is gone, and for all the compromises, all that they want is more compromise and more innovation, and we all know what happened to the conservative movement. It is a volume worth reading and studying. Ad kan, the topic of feminism. My dear students, I hope I'm wrong in my negative conclusion about Chovaveh and everyone in it, but if you really believe if there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, Chilul Tikkun Prizbul, then we're in a different world. It's one is the world that I received from my rebbeim, and the other one is a world that people are constructing today, which is totally alien to what I understand Torah to be.
Rebbe, I could just share one brief point on that, which is that when I've been in the Wexner Fellowship and been exposed to, you know, conservative
reform,
as well as many people who are part of Open Orthodox,
Maharaj,
and it becomes, not every person is the same, but it becomes very clear that overall, in general, even though their practice bases are often Orthodox in many respects, their value base is almost indistinguishable from the conservative
movement. No, listen, we have a terrible situation with the acceptance of homosexuality. And I can tell you, 90% of the people who claim they're homosexuals and lesbians are social. It is created, and I don't want to go into detail, Lona Imli, I just spoke with another Rebbe. We each had four cases in all our years of teaching. Each of us had four cases. And both of us said we 3.5 out of the four were solved. I explained the fourth case was the reason. I'm not certain that it was solved, but the other three were solved. And it's very, very sad. What's even worse is that people are being fired in America, are being sued and fined because the law of the land is
that homosexuality is perfectly normal, and you have to accept two men marrying, two women marrying. Look at the Gemara in Chulin, that Sadi Bet, and you will cry. You won't believe the description of the Gemara, Kotvin Alav Ketuvah, that even the most vulgar Gentiles didn't do it and sanctify it. And look where we're at today. It is very frightening. And this is why La Halacha, Ani Posek La Halacha, you cannot live in the United States. If you have a reason to live out of Israel, to learn Torah, to make money, to find a shidduch, the only country you can go to is Putin's Russia, the former Soviet Union, where the laws of the land do not recognize homosexuality. Aye, Putin's a killer. Morid b'malchut, you finished the quote. Finished. Ah, now we move on to a different topic, and we're going to have a lot of fun. I don't know if we're going to reach it entirely today, but here, a very interesting topic. I'm now Mishnah Halacha. Before we forget, do me a favor, whoever's in the class, this is the list that was begun last week. See to it that you have a contact number so that you can be contacted if Chas v'Chalila, I have to cancel class. From the hospital last week, I called Sherry, and I was so worried, and three people did come in vain. Now, the students living here are not that important as the outsiders. Let me just say, Natan Cohn, Vic Snow, Chaim Maltz, Avi Schwartz, Yitzchak Rubin, Alex Glassman, Simon Montagul. Oh, so there was here, I have to give it to Shavram Rachman, Stephen Bressler, Yomo, Michael Miller, okay. Not one second. Makorot, begin with 12. See if there's anyone else that has to sign in and put in, and see that everyone puts a contact number on it, okay? All right. Now, tell me, how many of you have gone to a Farbrengen? We always say Jews get together, Chassidish Jews. By the way, I'm quoting now from Mishnah Halachot, Chelik Vav, Siman, beginning with Siman Kuf Vav. It actually, what we're going to deal with is Kuf Vav, Kuf Zayin, and Kuf Chet. That is all part of one question that he got, or questions, and he just divided it up in his answers. And so you go to a Farbrengen, and what do? You sing, all right? You have a Purim Chagiga, you sing. More than that, you have Gramen, you have Lake Sunim, you have a wedding, you have a Batchan. We have so many different spin-offs from Nigunim and singing. Tell me, are we allowed to sing? Wasn't it after Churban Bayit that Chazal, and we paskin b'halacha, I'll give you the sources in a minute, that we put down a halacha that we do not sing, we do not rejoice, we don't indulge in something of laughter, churban habayit. Okay, so the person asking this question, we're going back, this tshuva is written in 1971. The name of the person he writes it to, Abraham Yitzchak Hoffman, Talmud Yeshivat Mir, Yerushalayim. Now there is a Rabbi Hoffman who writes in the Five Towns, Yair Hoffman. I wonder if there's any relationship here. It could be that this is his father, because he was a Talmud in the Mir in 71. He might have been in his mid-20s at the time. 71 would bring him today 47, 46 years later, 48 years later, make the cheshbon, he could very well be the father. I don't know who it is, I just know the name from the tshuva. And he's quoting that Zeich l'churbin, Shulchan Aruch, Arachayim, Siman, Tav, Kuf, Samech, Sif Katan Bet, and the Taz there, Sif Katan Hey. And they talk about the Taz quotes that many Sudat, they entertain the people that they sing Kaddish.
And isn't this a tremendous chet? The Taz writes, how are you allowed to sing? How are you allowed to have late sanim? How are you allowed to entertain if it's after Churban HaBayit? And here I'll tell you a good story to illustrate this. You all know the name Jackie Mason. So I know Jackie Mason's family from Lakewood, Mazer, M-A-Z-E-R. And he comes from a frum family. This is a Lakewood family, not a small matter. His brothers, Mismachim, Jackie learned in RJJ. I don't believe he had smicha, although people generally say he had smicha. They say he tells a joke when people laughed more at my jokes during my sermons than at taking my sermon seriously. I knew I had to become a comedian. Okay, and I've taught, you should know, relatives of his over the years. It's not an unknown family. All right, so Jackie.
Zera Aaron Cohen.
Excuse me.
Zera Aaron
Cohen. Okay, Kohanim, Kohanim, very nice. So this is Jackie Mason.
So he grew up from, and then
What are you talking about? Grew up 100% from. What do you think? Where do you think he grew up? Grew up, I believe, in the Lower East Side, but
is he totally secular?
No. Jackie Mason remained Jewish. His wife, I think he was married twice. Both wives were Jewish. He's a big supporter of Israel. Whether he's Shomer Shabbos today, I don't know. I can't answer. I would hope that he is, but I know that his nieces, who I taught, were angry at him, that they were raised, that their uncle is not frum enough, and that they were very upset with him. So Jackie Mason comes to Israel. This is many years ago. Yitzchak, were you here already when Jackie Mason came to perform? So first he goes to Tel Aviv, and he went to Tel Aviv and he performed, and it was Habima, wherever he performed, was a full house, and he was they recorded, it was on television, he was very good, and he was Jackie Mason as Jackie Mason is. Then he came to Yerushalayim, Binyanei Ha'umah. And this was later, I have it on a video actually, I think I still have it, but who can play a video today? And they panned the audience, I saw people I know. So Jackie Mason thinks he's in Tel Aviv, and you know, he's performing with his shtick. And then he breaks into a North Colored joke. And this is not Trump, this is not the American elections, this is Yerushalayim Mir HaKodesh. And he can sense the audience is upset with him. You follow? He, you know, a performer senses the audience. So he interrupts the joke. I saw this on TV. I wasn't there, but I can tell you, I still remember Yitzchak Fund was there. Jeffrey Fund was there. Some of my talmidim, I can still remember seeing their faces in the audience. And on the spot, pulls out a kippah, puts a kippah on his head, and goes into Kedusha of Musaf. Chazanis. And the place went crazy. He was so good. He had that audience eating out of his hands. So now, I want to ask you, are you allowed to do this? This is the question. This is the question that he's asking. And you're quoting the Taz, and the Taz is furious with these people. And you understand, you get together, Kaddish, what you can do with Kaddish, the Nusach of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom Kippur, and you can bring an audience to tears, you can bring an audience to laughter, and I have to tell you, the Kedusha, the Hu Yoshienu, what's behind it? Are you allowed? And then he asks a different question. And a very fascinating question. I'll tell you how the Rav got this question. But he asked the question, what about someone who has got problems with his nerves, mental? I know someone, I got this question, halakha l'maisa, a person who suffers from schizophrenia. They have a different name for it today. Anyone know? It's not exactly schizophrenia. I was explaining that there's a technical name.
There's a certain
name for this personality. Bipolar. Bipolar. What?
Bipolar is manic depressive.
Bipolar manic depressive. So it's moments that he's depressive, moments happy. Anyway, schizophrenia too is where you can be two different people at the same time. I believe it. And in the Ravnit, I saw it with my own eyes. In the Lower Lane, I've had cases where I had to visit people and I saw the problems. But all right, you need professionals to take care of it. So the question I got was that this person was told whenever he's alone, he has to have music on. Classical music. So the question I got is, he allowed to leave it on for Shabbos? And I consulted with a medical doctor. His feeling was yes, that I should tell him turn it on before Shabbos and close the door to the room where this music, and that's where you go when you want to hear music, but don't upset the rest of the family. But turn it on before Shabbat. Okay. So he asked the question, the Misha, who atzpani, can he listen to the music? Kumuvan, he says, Nigunei Chasidim, but can he listen? Or is this goes into the Gezeira of Chazal that you're not allowed to have music after Churban Habayit? Avraham, you know where the Rav got the Shaila? I remember Rebbe getting the Shaila before the summer. A young man came over to him and told him he has to do a lot of driving during the summer. He's going back and forth to the mountains. And in our time, everyone was going back and forth to Lower Lane. I remember in 55, a car crashed, and I still remember today, Norman Pilevsky. Recognize the name? He was killed in the car crash going up to the mountains. And a girl was going with him, a graduate of Central Yeshiva of Brooklyn, I believe her last name was Weiss. She took a lift, I think she was going up to the mountains to visit her parents, and they were both killed. He was driving all night or late at night, and he fell. And that night, I remember he came into the YU Beis Medrash, it was a Thursday night, to catch Marv. Remember, he davened Marv with our minion, and from there, the girl met him, and they drove, and believe it or not, he fell asleep at the wheel and went into a big pillar, that an overpass, and they were killed instantly. Hashem Yerachem. So this fellow asked the Rav, that Rebbe, with all my driving, I'm afraid I'll fall asleep at the wheel. Am I allowed to listen to music during the 3 weeks, and more important, during the 9 days, Shul Shechal Bal Tisha B'Av. I mean, you all know the halacha here. So it's a very similar question that Rav Menashe Klein got, a very similar question. And he says clearly that we all understand that Chazal were geyser against hearing music and playing music and Churban Habayit and wearing Avelut, but Rak Azru Zimra Lishen Tanug Uschok HaMeviyim Lidei Kalut Rosh. That it's understood that what Chazal meant, we can't play music, it's for the sake of happiness, the sake of joy. It leads to Kalut Rosh, and you all, no one here lives in a ghetto, you all understand what I'm talking about. I think, you know, I was at a wedding, a neighbor's grandchild that grew up before my eyes, and this is a girl that, for whatever the reasons are, it's a sad story, but she threw away Kol HaTorah Kula, everything. But she's finally getting married, and the reason that the Tel Aviv crowd, the North Tel Aviv crowd, why did they get married? It seems that they do get married when they want to have children. That they don't want the child to be born without at least that much there is there, that at least when you're going to bring a child into the world, that child should have a mother and father. We have to respect that. That's an achievement, because why should anyone get married today? Sex is a commodity like everything else. Children, what's it? But it shows a certain responsibility. So Malka and I felt we had to go to the wedding. I can't do that long driving anymore, but my daughter drove, didn't know where she's going. I mean, it's to me amazing with the, what's the system called? The Israeli... Waves, yeah. The Israeli system.
And we were there within an hour. I couldn't believe it, how not knowing where you're going, and there we are. So it was a very interesting night. Remember I told you what Zohar sent the rabbi, Lesedek Kedushin, and I saw these people the whole night, as late as they stayed. We went home earlier, but I heard it went on to 4 in the morning. They're drinking liquor, they're singing, they're dancing, they're all excited, they're happy. All right? But what's the happiness? What's the singing? I can just see it before my eyes, and the men, the women. All right. But we Jews, when you have a fabrengen to create a feeling, to create Yiret Shemayim, I mean, even in Lakewood, which was a hotbed of Lithuanian, when I was there, it was Mamish Litta. Nevertheless, every Shabbos afternoon, by Sudash Lishit, the Rosh Yeshiva Rabbarin would ask the Baal Menagein, Rabbi Getzel Rosenblatt. He has his shtibble on Vlai Street in Kew Gardens Hills. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where there are lots of minyanim. He was in Lakewood in my time, Reb Getzel. And he was a tremendous Baal Menagein, a wonderful Jew. Ugh. And he would start a niggin every week, and everyone would join in. This was Lakewood, but that was L'shem Shemayim. That's what Reb Menashe Klein is saying. One week, I don't remember whether it was Reb Getzel who pulled it or someone else pulled it off, they started a niggin. 9999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999 know I met my true love, whatever the words were. We're going back to the early 50s, and Rav Aharon loved the Niggun. Rav Aharon loved the Niggun. He said, Nochamo, Nochamo. So Rav Menashe Klein, as far as Leitzonis, is out. For the sake of Leitzonis, but for the sake of inspiration, absolutely. And then he quotes, he says that L'shem Refuah, if you have to hear the Niggun for the sake of feeling better, for the sake of getting well, he quotes that there already was a tshuva, he quotes from the Yad Yitzchak, that there was once a Jew who was very, very nervous, atzpani. He writes here, nervous balaz, like Rashi. Rashi uses old French, he uses English. Rav Menashe Klein knew English. Nervous balaz. And he took a phonograph and he would listen to the phonograph, to the record, and he felt wonderful, felt better. It was a refuah. And he went and asked this important Jew, wealthy Jew, went and asked, can he tell his Mishoret, the Gentile who worked in his house, can he tell him on Erev Shabbos that he'd like him on Shabbos to turn on the phonograph because his nerves act up when he doesn't hear music. During the week, he's busy. The nerves don't have a chance to act up. He's busy making money. He's busy doing major business deals, making decisions. But on Shabbos, when he finishes davening, he's nervous. And believe it or not, they were matting him to do it, to tell the guy. He said, the only problem you have to be careful about is that the neighbors will understand it's a guy who turned on the patiphone, the phonograph, Shelo Yitchalel, Shem Shamayim, and therefore you are permitted to tell him in advance what you want him to do. It's refuah, it's nerves, and if it helps you,
he was Mater. I can tell you with the Shiler of the guy driving in the car, the Rav said to him, how many people are in the car? Are they singing along with you? So the guy said, sometimes there'll be one person, two people in the car. No one's singing along. So I said, what's the Shiler? It's not Simchat Mereyot. You're allowed. You follow the Rav held that the Simchat Mereyot of the year of mourning, which is reflected in the 3 weeks, the 9 days, is when, you know, a Simcha, when you're singing, everyone is involved. But Stam, Natan is listening to a nigin that they attribute to the B'ditshuva, or they attribute to the first Rebbe, you know, in Chabad, the nigunim that they claim go back to the Baal Tanya. So to listen to a nigin like that, absolutely. Classical music, the Rav had a certain awe, I would say, for classical music. It's like Rembrandt. Rav Kook writes about Rembrandt that there has to be a certain Ruach HaKodesh in what Rav Kook did. I just saw now Makari Shon that some other Rabbanim discussing Rembrandt, his portrayal of Jews, it's beyond human understanding how he could reach such a beautiful level, sympathetic level, and portray them so beautifully. Rembrandt, the Rav, they say the Lubavitcher Rebbe too. I know musicians went in to talk with the Rebbe, and he showed a tremendous knowledge of classical music. Our classmate, the Moreno Rabbeinu, Dr. Grach, Harav Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, I'm told that he has a degree that he can lead a symphony orchestra, that he had classical music. I know that the Rav once asked Rabbi Kowalski to visit Rav Chaim. It goes back when he was here in Israel in the 60s into the 70s. And he came back and told the Rav that your son is not only master in Kol HaTorah Kula, but he has great knowledge of classical music. So you see, there is something to classical music. The Russians lead the world here as far as classical music. No one has equaled the great composers that have come out of the Russian land. There have to be reasons why: the winter, the cold, the summer, the land. There's a certain buoyance to life in Russia that reflects in some of the great composers. But you see, here he was Mater, and if he's Mater on Shabbos, then certainly during the week, if it's for the sake of refuah, of calming your nerves. And he says, Rabbi Menashe Klein says, L'chu'ura einaf yamina im hu imilim o below milim. Okay? Very, very fascinating, the first part of the tshuva. Now, he then goes a step further, and here we come to something very contemporary. It's actually in the news, and I just heard a Dasha Mizrahi, this Musa giver, what's his first name? Yitzchak Mizrahi, am I right? I've heard him in English, I hear him now in Hebrew, I have a disc in him. He's in Israel, he lives in Queens today. Mansi. What's his first name? Rabbi Yossi Mizrahi. He's created tremendous controversy. Sometimes he goes off quite wild, but I just heard him on this very topic. I grew up in Yeshiva Srebis Kolchanan in the Harry Fisher Base Medrash. Noise never bothers me. Why? Because in the Base Medrash there were a few hundred students there learning, and when you're learning, you're singing, you're making noise, nikunim, and the Gemara, and the way you read it. And this has long been part of our world. As a matter of fact, there was just a delegation here from South Korea, but I think there was another delegation. That's what Mizrahi talks about, the South Korean delegation.
I think my son-in-law, my son-in-law works today, who was in the army for many years, works for the government today. So certain delegations come and they appoint my son-in-law to be their host. You got to remember, my son-in-law was born in Canada. He came here a little kid, but English is his first language. English, I mean, Hebrew is equal to English, but they're two native languages for him. He was born in English, his first years in English, and then, of course, like my children, the same story, went to school in Hebrew. So he told me the same story, and I think the story was in the newspapers. This delegation from South Korea, they took to Panovich. And they couldn't believe it. A few thousand men learning, singing, and they praised what the study of the Talmud, and you know, in South Korea, they now have bestsellers in South Korea. And my grandson, who worked for a South Korean company for a while, showed it to me, the Talmud in the South Korean language. They think this is why the Jews win Nobel Prizes, were the brightest people in the world because of the Talmud.
Maybe some secular Jews would apply the same logic.
No, beside that, that's a different story. So this delegation from Germany, they took them to Hebron Yeshiva, right across the street. And my son-in-law told me that when their trip was over, my son-in-law showed them, and this one showed them, and that one showed them. This was a very important delegation. And they showed them Kol Tov Eretz Yisrael. They said, what impressed you the most? Hebron Yeshiva. 1,500, 1,700 young men sitting and learning and all that noise. And now the question came up, Hoffman is bothering Reb Menashe Klein. All right, we've now established you're allowed to hear records and sing, all for the sake of Kedusha inspiration. Secondly, it would be permissible if you feel it's for your nerves. Atzpani, nerves in English, nervous system. You feel better hearing music, all right? People can make a case, I think better when I sing. I have clarity when I sing. And I have to admit it, that at times at home I'm learning, and I break into a song out of, and the people, you know, my grandchildren know, everyone looks at me. But all right, that's the way we learn. Ah, are you allowed to learn and sing? Chazal said, no singing since Churban Habayit. So he quotes the Gemara from Megillah, Daf Lamed Bet, Amid Aleph, Amar Reb Shvatim, Reb Yochanan, Kol HaKorei Belo Ne'ima V'Shoneh Belo Zimra, Alav HaKatuv Omer, V'Gam Ani Natati Lahem Chukim Lo Tovim. And Tosfot explains there, you'll see it, everyone's learned Masechet Megillah. Tosfos explains so beautifully, if you learn with the Nigin, you remember it better. And you all know this is absolutely true, that I know that when I daven, and I daven quickly, Ba'al Peh, it doesn't have as much an effect on me as when I can hold the Siddur and read the words and whisper them, hear it with my own ears. This is, and the difference, by the way, I daven this way or that way, it depends on the minyan I'm with. Unfortunately, most minyanim I daven with during the week, they go too quickly for me. So I have to daven, I want to hear Birchat Kohanim. Inevitably, when I finish Shmon Esrei, everyone is saying Modim, and I want to catch Birchat Kohanim. Let me have the coin in my shul is President Shazar's great-nephew. So to get a bracha from Shlur Zalman Shazar's great-nephew is a special bracha. It's a kohen, and what yichis? So it was his mother's uncle. He still remembers Uncle Zalman, Shlur Zalman Shazar, Rubishaf. He was president of the state of Chabadnik from youth
who later in life came back for Leg Venefish, and in America he went to see the Rebbe. You don't know what went on here. I was living here already. Oh, they were furious. The president of Israel goes to a rabbi. The rabbi should come to the president, but go and explain to Haaretz and Yediot what's meant a chassid, what it means to be a chassid. So if you sing, you remember better. This is why I can tell you on Yontif, on Musaf, on Rosh Hashanah, I sing the whole Malkiyot Zikrona Shofret, because the halacha says we're allowed to say it aloud, because no one's saying anything by heart. Everyone is reading a siddur. So you're not going to confuse anyone if you make a little noise. So it's brought down the halacha. You're allowed to say it a little bit aloud. So, I can say it, I can think it. So he quotes the Gemara, and that here, what is the question? But then he quotes other Gemaras, where the Gemara is very negative towards singing, and he explains there's a big difference when you're singing and you're having feeling and you're doing it lehip or root. That is much, certainly allowed, much better than learning without singing. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kofalef, Hakore Pasik, Mishir Hashirim Kemin Zema. The Gemara is so negative. Why? That already is the North Tel Aviv crowd. That singing to enjoy, express life, joy, love. When Bnei Akiva, we used to dance, there were dance troupes where they would dance to psukim from Shir HaShirim. All right, I'll pee din. Today I'm much older and I'm a little bit smarter. Very hard lahatir itself, very difficult. I don't want to say an isa, maybe people still do it, but it depends why you're singing. Are you singing for the sake of hit or root, for the sake of kedusha, for the sake of learning, or are you singing for the sake of a Hollywood song, a TV song, a reality show? The ability, reality shows in Israel, are you allowed to participate? By the way, there have been some Haredi kids who have done very well, and they asked Shailat Shailas before, are we allowed to participate? So he says, singing of this type may be forbidden, but singing when learning, absolutely permissible. And then he goes on, and again, what we come about in the sources, look into the Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Haim, look into the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchat Churban Habayit at the end of Aruch Haim, that there's also a big difference how you sing. If you're singing with clean ginar and drinking wine, then it's much more questionable. Are you allowed? If you're singing just for the sake of the song, then it should absolutely be permissible. And you have to judge in accordance with the circumstances. So it's a very interesting question. A lot has been written about music. There's a famous Tshuvat HaBach. I believe Solomon Freihoff quotes him. Anyone know who I'm talking about? Rabbi Freihoff? Am I pronouncing the name right? Yes. Solomon was the first name, if I recall correctly. Pittsburgh, yeah. Very fascinating individual. Two volumes that had a great influence on me that came out in the late 40s, early 50s. Rabbi Solomon Freihoff was a Reform rabbi. He lived in Pittsburgh, and his scholarly interest was responsible literature. Now, he wasn't a great Langdon, but he knew a lot more than the average Reform rabbi, but he had the blessing that in Pittsburgh
there was a great Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Wolf Leider, Zev Leider. I taught the grandchildren of his. He has descendants living in Israel, Leider. You'll come across the name occasionally. And whenever he had difficulty, Rabbi Leider would help him out with the text, and he thanks him in the introduction. Now, these two volumes are fabulous. If you would think they were written by someone doing a doctorate at Bernard Rebel Graduate School or Bar Ilan University. One volume is the history of response literature, and he's excellent. Deals with it, beginning with the Gemara and the Gaonic period, coming into the Mishnayim, the Achronim. He deals with the great controversies in Halacha. I'll give you a simple example. He deals with the controversy over matzah. You don't realize today you buy a box of matzah, machine matzah, Jews killed each other over whether one could use such matzah, machine matzah. The whole shaila of the Lishma, that how can you make matzah with machines? You need a Lishem mitzvah matzah, certainly for the Mashmura matzah that you want to use at the Seder. And then what about the chametz? How can you guarantee that there's no chametz that fell off that you didn't see? It's not like canned matzah that you put in and take out. Here it's machines working. Tremendous controversy. Today, Baruch Hashem, there are people that only will use machine matzah because it's halakhically no problem with the Lishma, because it's the Jew that turns the machines on and says Lishem mitzvah matzah, and the kashrut is better than Mishchen matzah. I know that I was told the Rav felt that way. I believe we established Rav Aaron Soloveitchik felt that way. And I've seen with my own eyes. I've been in hand matzah bakeries and machine matzah bakeries, and I stick to machine matzah. But don't learn from me, but Gedolei Yisrael, if this is correct, I can understand it very well. So he deals with all this. Then he has a second volume, a treasury of response literature. The treasury of response literature is Avi, selections from every period of an actual response translated into English. And what does he pick up from the Bach, Rabbi Yol Sirkus, we're dealing with Poland, 1600s, that Jews were in a bar, in a kretschmer, and they in, and the goyim were getting drunk and singing songs. And they liked the songs. And before you know it, the chazan in shul was using that niggun for the tefillah. Are you allowed? Very interesting question. Here, you just saw the story I told you. The niggun, on top of old Smoky, all covered with snow. Are you allowed to turn that into a niggun?
In the Middle Ages, that happened all the time.
The young Israels, they should only even know. I don't know. Christmas time. Silent night. How does it go? I don't know. You follow me? The tune of Silent Night. I don't want to do it. I'm not a Catholic.
Those are cantorial music.
So what did you say that? Here, Chabad. Some of the most famous Chabad Nigunim, when they go into Russian. These are old time Russian songs. Marches, Nigunim. So the Bach Paskins Lahalacha, that if it isn't pure church music, you're allowed to use it. And this is what Reb Menashe Klein, getting involved here with music, Lima Torah, and Halacha Lamaisa, we can be Mata music, we can be Mata classical music, I mean, contemporary music, rap music with all the cursing and all that's in it, that we can't be matir. But Jewish rap music, adarabba v'adarabba. I see famous Jewish musicians, Afro-Americans, walking past me, black clothes, tzitzit out, beards, payas, converts written up all over. Ribbono shel olam, we can be very proud, wonderful. So all this we can understand,
But the next part of the question is what we're going to devote a good, if not the entire shiur next week, next time we meet, the Sunday after Sukkot, a week later. And gentlemen, then evidently Rabbi Hoffman, asking the question, was playing a game. First he asked about music in general and phonograph and nerves and learning Torah and nigunim. And then the question comes, there's someone out there, doesn't give the name, but we can give the name, Rav Shlomo LeKalbach, are you allowed to hear his nigunim? That is the question. And you'll see what that opens up, the Machleket HaPaiskim on Shlomo LeKalbach.
And there's not a chazan in the world who doesn't use it.
What are you talking? Today, Shlomo LeKalbach is all over the Haredi world as well.
That's what I just said.
Not just our world. But the question is interesting. You'll see his approach, Reb Moshe's approach, and I want to introduce you to a sefer that tries to understand Shlomo LeKalbach. We'll try to understand him.
Remember, you told us about consensus.
Right.
The consensus in the Jewish religious world today
is
to use Shlomo LeKalbach.
Right, but I'm saying that we'll see what Reb Moshe. We'll see what Reb Moshe has to say. But I'm also going to try to understand who was Shlomo LeKalbach. Remember, I knew him. I can't say I knew him intimately, but I knew him quite well. And who was he? What went wrong and what is good? And why is there the consensus on Shlomo
LeKalbach? The music of Simon and Garfunkel as applied to his newest Shabbos.
Right, no, I know right here Tchaikovsky's goes with it. It's not even a problem because there is a guy with a tremendous neshama. That's what I said about. That's what I said. That's what I said. That's what I said about the Russians. It's amazing. All right, so to reiterate, we finished out feminism today. I introduced you to Bauman's biography of Harry Epstein. Anyone from Atlanta can really appreciate that biography. You have to be able to see the temple and what it was like in its heyday. And who would believe that Atlanta today is a capital of Balei Tshuva? What the Feldman father and son rabbis have done is one of the shining examples of finding yourself as a Jew again.
Could you explain the phrase, when you get married, Kedat Moshe Yisrael?
No.
Yeah. What the heck does that mean if Kedat Moshe is halacha? In Yisrael, you could say the minhag.
No, what it means, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, is that our concept of marriage is in accordance with the way the Torah people understand it.
Why does it say Yisrael?
Because what you just said, consensus. There's a way Jews have lived throughout the millennium. And there's a way Jews have acted. There can be machlokot and halacha, but there's halacha l'maiser, away we go. That's Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. I would say Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. And Torah Shebal Peh works with the klal, Hivaskim Olim Kol Yisrael. Okay? That's what it means, essentially. Gentlemen, does anyone want a copy of Torah to go? They were giving them out. I think they're all out of it already. Please pass this back to Yitzchak. And Michael, this is for you. Remember Bob Gibson?
I certainly do.
Okay, you're going to enjoy this book. Pass it on to whoever you want.
Thank you.
I read it from cover to cover.
I've given Billy Morin to three or four people already.
All right, it's brand new, but it's...
He was a
pitcher, an unbelievable pitcher who hated. He didn't talk to a batter. This is...
Really?
He hated. He was known for his... You'll read it, you'll see. This is a review of Avinoham Frankl's Nefesh HaChaim, where he deals with Midah HaTzimtzum. The review is written by my student, Betzal Na'ar. And if Rakefet's going to go to heaven, one of the reasons is that a wild kid came into his class in the 60s named Richie Nair. And he terrorized the other kids. He was from Bangor, Maine. And his poor Rebbe, Ani Rothkopf, had such love for that kid and helped him, and he became, instead of Richinaya, that's the Tzal Na'ar, a genius in Jewish philosophy, published many, many Sfarim. This is what got Yom Awol excited. Lo techalalel et shen kadshi, against talking Lashon Hara, and it's about Tzom Gedalia, but it's to catch your attention, it makes believe it's happening now. If anyone wants, I have one last copy of the Rav's talk on why we can't do wholesale Hafkad Kedushin. And here's on the Baruch Be'Leibowitz on his yard site, very nice memoir article. This is from the New York Times about the J. Levine Judaica bookstore. Danny Levine is my student, the guy who runs it today, a lovely individual. But the New York Times wrote it up. I think it's the oldest Jewish Judaica store in that's still functioning in the entire United States. And here's an article, a letter about Shvut Ami, about Russian Jewry and what's being accomplished. And if you read it, you'll understand why I dedicated my new volume to Shvut Ami and why I have kicked Yomo out of the Monday class and told him he has to go to Shvut Ami and learn B'chavruta. And finally, very interesting, the Mashpia of Yeshiva University, my Talmud Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, comes out against all these books that are being written on Al-Chayt, 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 and what it means and how many sins. And he says, this is not Judaism. We have to be positive and we have to be happy. It's a real Hasidish vibe, but there's a lot of truth. And he quotes the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon said, you only say the Al-Chayt once. I say Slichus in the morning. I say the Al-Chayt once, not three times. Vilna Gaon, Ein Achinami. So there's something to be said for this. My dear students, before I say Das Vedanya, I wouldn't miss tomorrow's class. For all the people who will be watching the second debate between Trump and Clinton, tomorrow I'm dealing with David Berger and the Rebbe, and more topics. You see what I'm going to reach. Be'ezrat Hashem. Until we meet again, health and happiness, and now we're going to daven Mariv, Vic, Bahurachum. Bahurachum.